Welcome to the Live Your Life podcast, episode number 5. In this episode, I'm talking about narcissistic and antisocial behavior patterns and how to understand your relationship to them. I want to give you a warning. This episode can be very intense. There's a lot of information in here that may be very triggering, especially if it's not something that you have considered before. I really want to invite you to turn it off if you feel triggered and get some support if it's something that you feel you need help with. We are not diagnosing anybody in this conversation. We are just having a conversation and educating people about behavior patterns, not diagnoses. I also want you to be aware that these behavior patterns are on a spectrum. No human being is perfect. And if you find that you need support, please find somebody to support you who has experience with this topic. This is not a healthcare service. We are not diagnosing anybody. Find support for yourself if you feel that you need it, and definitely push pause if you find yourself being triggered. Everything expressed in the Live Your Life podcast is either my opinion or the opinion of my guest, and this is not a replacement for healthcare services. If you find yourself in need of therapy or other healthcare services, please seek out resources for that. I'm Jasmine Savari, and welcome to the Live Your Life podcast. As a coach with a master's degree in psychology, I know that so many of us are missing the authentic experience of truly living our lives. I want to inspire you with conversations that expand your consciousness and empower you to create the best life possible. Let's start living now, because now is all we have. Hi, Frances. Welcome to the Live Your Life podcast.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, welcome. So why don't you tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do?
Well, I'm an attorney, and I help counselors often, or other licensees in this state, if they have complaints from the Department of Health. But with the hope that they won't have complaints from the Department of Health, I help them with consultation on ethics issues and legal issues. Before becoming an attorney, I also, and I still am, a social worker, although now I work as an attorney, but I have a background as a social worker. And as a social worker, I had a broad range of experience working clinically as a therapist with children, adults, couples, families, groups, individuals. Children were often, you know, part of the SIP ship, might have been 2 years old or up to 18. And then I worked in research, psychiatric research at two major medical schools at major institutions. And then I also worked with people who were court mandated to services because of domestic violence. I worked with people who were targets of domestic violence. I really have a broad range of experience, I think, that has also included working with people with narcissism and psychopathy.
So the reason that we connected is, I don't even know how it happened, but somehow we got on a conversation of narcissism and psychotherapy. So when we connected, I was able to learn that you have done this talk quite a bit. You have a roadmap for what you want to talk about. So why don't you give us an overview of the roadmap, and then I'm just going to let you drive, because I think that you've done enough research to know what's important and what you want to talk about. And let's give everybody an idea of what you're going to cover.
Okay. All right. Well, to start with, I just want to say, you know, a bit of a disclaimer. I want to say that this presentation or this discussion is for educational purposes only, and that I am not here to diagnose anybody, and this is not legal representation. It's not consultation. It's not, in terms of therapy, I'm not giving therapy. It's not, you know, not supervision. It's not even therapeutic consultation. It's really just educational and informational. Just want to start out with that.
Perfect. And also, let's add, everything that you say and everything that I say is based on my opinion, my personal experience. Mm-hmm. It's not advice. It's not healthcare services. Yes. In any way, shape, or form.
Yes. Thank you. Exactly. That's absolutely right. Okay. So in terms of a roadmap, I want to talk a little bit about vocabulary, because it's important to at least be on the same page in terms of the words that we use. And then to touch base with a bit of why one person might respond one way to people with narcissistic behaviors and other people might respond another way. Talk a little bit about what is or isn't a narcissist for purposes of this talk. There are some people who want to know why me, why does this keep happening to me? So I'll talk a bit about theories of personality. Is there a pattern and what the dynamics might be? How people pick you out of a crowd if you're somebody who gets involved in these relationships, and then the dynamics, and also to talk about how to, if you should want to, how to repel a narcissist, and then how to recover or what's involved in recovery from these relationships. So that's broadly what I'll be speaking about. In terms of the vocabulary itself, I think it's really important to distinguish what some of the words mean as we go. So when people use the word narcissist or narcissistic, there's the question of whether they're talking about behaviors or a personality disorder. There's a diagnostic statistical manual, DSM number 5, that talks about narcissistic personality disorder. I'm not so much going to be talking about that today because there are certain criteria, and if a person fulfills certain criteria, they're considered to have a personality disorder. But in fact, I think for these relationships, it's important for people to be able to look at the behaviors. And I'm not here to diagnose anybody, and I don't want anyone to walk away from this talk thinking that they're able to now diagnose people, because that's not really the point of this talk. The point is to help people who are engaged in these relationships to actually begin to understand why and how that happens. So I'm really hoping that people will look at themselves and see where the dynamics lead them.
I think a really important thing, what you just said is really important, to talk about the characteristics of somebody who ends up in a narcissistic relationship and why they may look to data to try to validate their experience. And so mm-hmm. I love what you're saying, that it doesn't necessarily matter. What matters is what's happening for them and being able to trust themselves, which I think you'll dive into later.
Right. Right. And I think it's also important to look at the difference between whether you're actually attracting narcissists or whether it's just that you keep them, you know, whether you stay around. Because there are, you know, you can ask the question, like, how does this happen? And you can have a situation where you could have two people, one who we might call a narcissist magnet and one who's not. And the narcissist magnet, when presented with fairly unreasonable behaviors, the narcissist magnet will stay, whereas the person who's not a narcissist magnet will get up and leave. So that's an important thing to be able to look at, is why do you stay? What is it that's going on? A person who's a narcissist magnet tends to be highly, almost compulsively relational. That is to say that they're relational even when it's not to their benefit. So let me go back and just talk a little about the vocabulary to start with. So instead of talking about good or bad or language that is putting particular value one way or the other, I prefer to talk about people as being relational versus non-relational in this context. So relational people, in my mind, are people who engage in relationship for the sake of relationship. People who are non-relational or transactional are people who engage in the relationship for the sake of the transaction. So a person who's relational, they'll engage in a relationship because it's fun or because it's interesting or because they like the person. You know, I don't know. I just like the person. And they'll have that relationship. They'll engage in a friendship or something else with that person, something more. But a transactional person will be very specific, very, very intentional about the reasons to be in the relationship. I once heard somebody say to someone else, she said, we should be friends. It would be very useful. And the person said it completely sincerely. You know, she didn't think that it was problematic at all, but she was making it very clear that her purpose for engaging in the relationship would be for how useful it was. And I thought that was interesting, not just the words, but the dynamic behind the comment. I also might use the terms pro-social versus antisocial. And pro-social refers to behaviors that actually support social norms. So things like stopping at a red light or you know, not harming people, not hitting somebody, being polite. If someone tells you that you've hurt their feelings, to be concerned. Antisocial behavior is behavior that is actually against social norms, where people might feel like they're special or they shouldn't have to follow the rules that other people have to follow. And then I also want to make the distinction of judgment versus discernment or condemnation. one of the things that I often hear from relational people, and the reason that they don't want to draw boundaries with other people, with transactional people or other people, is because they don't want to seem judgmental. Relational people can be very caught up in that. I don't want to seem, that's so judgmental. I don't want to be judgmental. So I encourage people instead to think in terms of being discerning versus condemning. That we should all be discerning. We should be paying attention and seeing how relationships are affecting us or how people are behaving with us or how we are behaving, as opposed to condemning. I mean, if you see that someone isn't observing your boundaries, or if you think somebody's being mean to you, it doesn't mean that you're saying they should be shot at dawn or anything, but it does mean that you want to show, and to yourself as much as anybody else, that you're seeing what's going on and that it's not okay with you. Any questions about that? Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes total sense.
Okay, so the problem may not be so much if you attract narcissists, it's more, why do you keep them, or why do you not repel them, or why do you hang out in those relationships? Why do you remain? In general, I think, you know, one of the big questions to me is, how do they pick you out? Like, how does a person walk into a room, look over the room, and go, that person, that's going to be a good target? And I think it's a combination of things. I think on the one hand, it's kind of a broad net that a person who's looking for a target might, I don't know, just sort of try out anybody. They might just do something that cast a broad net and see who's gonna respond. And so, in a sense, you identify yourself to the person. But on the other hand, there are also little tests that they look at, or ways that they can discern that you might be a good target that would be interesting or fun for them. So, for instance, let's say if a person is sitting at a table with you and just talks about how difficult their life has been, or how the complicated relationships that they have, or how they've abused other people, a narcissist magnet will be interested in that. They'll say, really? Tell me more. Or if they go on a date and the person treats them badly, the narcissist magnet will think, oh, wow, that person must have really been struggling, and how can I help? Whereas somebody else will just get up and go. And they won't really be interested in hanging around. So for a person who's a magnet, that person will tolerate being devalued. They'll have a huge sense of responsibility, so they'll take on responsibilities that aren't theirs. They'll try to repair any possible perceived breach in what I call what's called mirroring, where you mirror back what the person wants. You develop a relationship anyway, and the narcissist magnet will just, before they know it, they're in a relationship that can be quite problematic. People compare it, I don't know if you've ever heard this term about the frog in the water, this idea that if you take, I don't know if it's true or if it's metaphorical, but in any case, it's a useful image where if you take a frog or a living being, say a frog, and you put it in a pot of cold water, it will stay in the cold water. If you were to put a frog in a pot of boiling water, it would jump out of the water. But if you put it into cold water and slowly turn up the heat, the frog won't know when to leave, and it'll end up being boiled. And that's how these relationships can be.
I think it's important to address, you said, you know, they'll sit and talk to somebody about all their problems and all the injustices that they've experienced. It seems like normal social behavior to connect and listen to what somebody's saying. But I think, just so we avoid any confusion, like, what exactly is problematic in that if it's a narcissist magnet talking to a narcissist?
That's a good question.
I mean, one thing to think about is how confusing this is. So if we look at one specific incident, it may look fine, but that's also part of the way that it works. Like we talked about the intermittent reinforcement, which we'll talk about later, but looking at the patterns it's not just one thing.
Yeah. Well, for instance, so people often are who they are. I mean, we can change, but people, when a person changes, they have to really want to change. So in general, people will be who they are. So if you're sitting and talking to somebody, and let's say they tell you about past relationships, and they might tell you in the past, they'll tell you that, let's say they provoked a person into a fight and then taped the fight. Like, this is an example that I witnessed, where a person in this case, it was a man telling me that he was married and he used to enjoy listening to the fights that they would have. So he would provoke his wife into a fight and then had the tape, made a tape of it, and then played the tape for the new prospective girlfriend. And the prospective girlfriend listened to the tape and thought, oh, wow, okay, how did you feel about that? Or why, you know, that must have been a difficult fight. What happened? Tell me about it. Instead of paying attention to the fact that this person admitted that he provoked the person into a fight, that it was really about nothing, so that he could listen for his entertainment. Now, that's interesting, to say the least, if not problematic, that this person is now listening, has full evidence that the person she's considering as a boyfriend has done this stuff, and yet there she is. So if that happened to her late further down the line, it couldn't be surprising because she knew he told her that this happened, and yet she remained in the relationship and then became the target of that same exact behavior. And there can be lots of other examples. I mean, it can be a person talking about how nobody else ever measures up, and you're listening to that and you think, wow, okay, well, he must have high standards. Maybe I'll meet those standards, instead of thinking, well, maybe nobody measures up because nobody's ever going to measure up. And hearing the story that the person tells really gives a lot of information. My experience in terms of interviewing people, as well as speaking with people in general, is that people will often tell you who they are. They will tell you, they'll say, I'm not good enough for you, or you're too good for me, or I could never do this, or I could never do that. And so they tell you, they'll tell you who they are, but the narcissist magnet or the highly, highly relational person won't pay attention because they just don't want to believe it. They can't believe it. So yeah, it's not just someone, you know, sort of talking about their lives or saying how they feel about things. It's really behaviors that could be very revealing and very helpful from the start, but people just don't want to hear it.
And we'll go into this further too, but there's a specific type of personality that's going to be vulnerable to this, where they, like you just said, they can't believe what they're hearing. And so they wouldn't see this as a problem.
Yeah. I do want to take a moment to say that narcissism isn't autism, for instance. I mean, there are some people who have autistic behaviors, or now it's referred to as on the spectrum, where a person might not be, have a full-blown autistic diagnosis of autism, but where they might have certain behaviors where they're kind of, they can't read social cues. And so it might seem as though they're being narcissistic when in fact they're just not understanding what the social cues are. And also sometimes mania or bipolar disorder can be confused with narcissism, or even borderline personality disorder. So I just want to say that. And also I want to say that when we talk about narcissism, there is a spectrum that we're talking about. And if you were to talk about a scale of 1 to 10 of people seeking admiration, I would say that we all seek admiration to some extent. And it's healthy to want to seek admiration or to want to be admired. But it's got to do with the degree and the scale. So when people get to like a 7.5, 8, like that, that's where it becomes where you can talk about, where some people would talk about almost pathology, or where things become really very, very problematic within a relationship. But basically, the idea of narcissism is that a person needs to be admired by others for social acknowledgement, and that this need is excessive and insatiable and unremitting. It just doesn't end. If a person needs to be admired, and you can admire them or you can give them good feedback, and it just will never be enough. It just keeps going. But the other side of it is that these people can be very charming or engaging on some level. Now, I've heard different people speak. They have different labels or different categorizations. I kind of think of it in three categories. One is the sort of flagrant or flamboyant narcissist, and then the covert narcissist, and then the malignant narcissist. So the flamboyant or flagrant, that's the person who kind of walks into the room and just takes the air out of the room. That's the person who's always very made up, or they're very into presentation. And that's the person that more often than not you think of when you think of as a narcissist. Then there's the covert narcissist, and the covert narcissist is somebody who actually seems very self-effacing, but the fact is that they still seek admiration, and they still are pretty, nothing is ever enough in terms of your adulation. That person might come off as very quiet, very unassuming, quote, good citizen, somebody who does a lot for the community, or in a house of worship, or maybe in a school system where they volunteer a lot, they're big on volunteering. And that can be one way that the narcissism can be manifested. And then there's the malignant narcissist, who is a person who really can be quite damaging and to other people and relationships. They will actually get other people to do their ill bidding and to put other people down. Happens a lot in workplaces and in families, where somebody might start a rumor about someone and get other people to spread the rumor, which can be very damaging to people. Also, with people with a diagnosis of narcissism, and also some of the behaviors, is that there's a lack of empathy, and that they would disregard the feelings of others. That can come across through breaking promises, or that there's a lack of reciprocity in the relationship. So, for instance, if somebody makes a promise and breaks the promise, relational people tend to take promises very seriously. So the relational person might go to the other one and say, but you promised. I mean, you said you'd do this, and now you're not doing it. And the transactional person or the narcissist will say something like, well, yeah, but things change. I mean, I promised, but I can only keep a promise if I can keep a promise. It might change. Circumstances change. And so in their mind, it's absolutely fine that they didn't keep the promise. Also, the question of reciprocity is a big one, where relational people are very into doing for other people. Actually, relational people will even do a lot for people, not expecting anything in return, except that they hope that when they do need something, that the person will be there for them because of how much they've done. But in fact, there is no reciprocity. Or if there's the appearance of reciprocity, it's really for the purpose of hooking the person in. But it's not usually sincere reciprocity. There's also a lack of remorse, where if you hurt somebody's feelings, they don't care. There's a lot of arrogance or an exaggerated sense of self-importance, and that they feel very entitled to whatever it is that they're getting. So there's certainly no reason to have to repay the behavior, or, as I said, have reciprocity, because in fact, I knew of one example where the relational person had done certain things had done a lot of favors, a lot of service for the transactional person. And the relational person said, well, don't you even want to say thank you? And the other person said, well, no, you should be thanking me because I gave you the opportunity to do something good for people. So it just never ends. I mean, it's really, I'm kind of laughing because in terms of a relational point of view, it seems so absurd. But these are things. And then another thing that narcissistic people will say a lot is that they're the smartest person in the room. You hear this a lot. And what the relational person doesn't understand is that they actually mean it. Like, it doesn't matter who's in the room. They think that they're the smartest person in the room. And what goes along with it is that they have entitlements and power and should be considered in ways that nobody else should get to be considered. So, but what I was starting to say is that if the person just presented with all these things, anybody would run for the hills. But the problem is that they're also extremely charming and seductive. So the pattern can be that they identify you, and then they idealize you. You know, people call it love bombing. I think it's a term that's been used a lot. And so they know what people want, and they know what people need, and they know how to engage people, and they do. So, you know, they know how to compliment you, or how to, that is to say, it can be complimenting you in your appearance, but it can also be complimenting you for your ideas, or they have an uncanny ability to understand how you would want to be complimented. And then they do. And then you feel, the relational person feels very comfortable in the relationship. And then things start to change. So although I don't think of a narcissistic person as being essentially, at their essence, predatory, there can be certain aspects of it that do engage or that do target other people. Now, there's a huge overlay between narcissistic behaviors and antisocial behaviors. And so you can have somebody who's, sometimes the words that are used are sociopath or psychopath. There can be a heavy overlay, but there are differences between them. And I'll just say that, so the diagnostic term is antisocial, meaning, as I explained, as opposed to prosocial behavior, antisocial. But sometimes people use the words sociopath or psychopath. It's a complicated history of the use of those words, and people use them differently. Some people feel that they're basically all the same and they're interchangeable. And some people would say that somebody who's a sociopath is somebody who's had learned behaviors. Like maybe they grew up in a family where they were taught, you know, don't let them get them before they get you. Instead of do unto others as you'd have them do unto you, they learn get them before they get you. And so they're taught, or maybe they grew up in a family where they were taught to steal or taught to get over on people. And that would be a learned behavior, which some people would call sociopathic behavior. And then other people make the distinction that a psychopath is somebody who has something like a diagnostic or a psychiatric problem that causes them to do things that are harmful to other people. For purposes of this conversation, I don't know that it's necessarily necessary to make that distinction in terms of the etiology or where it all comes from. It's more, as I said, I think it's important to look at the behaviors themselves. But with somebody who's antisocial, there's a lot of, also a lot, same as narcissism, a lack of empathy, a lack of remorse, an inability to achieve real intimacy, and a lot of exploitation. The difference being that the narcissist will exploit people for purposes of being admired, whereas the antisocial person will exploit people for purposes of control and sometimes harm. They kind of enjoy harming people.
So I want to jump in really quick and ask you a question about the transactional person. So you just said a narcissistic person will exploit people for admiration, and antisocial people will exploit people for control. So as we talked about earlier, a relational person is looking for somebody who they can have a relationship with, somebody they feel good with, they connect with, they can have intimacy. The transactional person, can you say a little bit about what it is that they're looking for in the relationship? Why are they doing all of these things?
They're looking for the transaction that they seek, whatever that might be. So for a narcissist, they're looking for admiration. It's kind of like a log. I think of it as like a log in a fire. Like if I'm a narcissist, I see people as a source of warmth, let's say, in that like the log metaphor. So if I'm looking for a source of warmth, I get myself a log, I put it in the furnace, I burn the log, and then I get another log. I don't sit around thinking, oh, look at the ash. It used to be such a beautiful log. I wish I had my log back. They don't care about that. It's all that matters is what the function was, and they get another log. Another example that I once read about was where somebody was a runner, but couldn't find a pair of shoes that he could run in. And he finally, because he kept getting shin splints, and so he finally found this particular brand of sneakers, and turned out he was able to run, which was great. So he loved the sneakers. They were his favorite sneakers. He talked to everybody about the sneakers. And then after about a year, the sneakers were no good, and he got rid of the sneakers. He didn't sit around thinking, oh, I wish I could have my sneakers back. You know, he just got another pair. So that's kind of the dynamic that goes on. That's with a narcissist dynamic. With an antisocial person, the fun comes out of manipulation or just being deceitful. There's a certain callousness that often goes along with the behavior, and they can be very hostile. There's what's called disinhibition, where they're not inhibited by social norms, so they can be very irresponsible and impulsive. The impulsivity can, you know, people think of impulsivity as being like wild behavior, but it can really just be even making stuff up, which is lying, you know, just kind of saying what's convenient at the moment, taking a lot of risks or risking other people's behavior. The way that that person will express it is that they'll just say, oh, I'm so bored. I'm so much, you know, you bore me, or this isn't really worth my while. So they'll come up with something that's sort of dangerous. So it can be different for different people. But that's really it's sort of almost how they see the interaction, what they want to get out of the interaction. And it can be very crazy making, because with both of those types, the antisocial and the narcissist, they can be very charming and very engaging. And the person who's, I will call them hyper relational, because we're all, I hope we're all relational, but if you're hyper-relational to the point where you remain in a relationship even against your better interests, then that would be part of why you would remain in these relationships.
So I think defining some people don't even know what their better interests are, which I think is what allows them to be hyper-relational. The other thing I'm curious if you can just talk a little bit about is just intimacy, because I think some people may not even know what that means. So a relational person is capable of intimacy, where the other transactional type of person, you said that they're not capable of intimacy. What does that mean?
Okay. Yeah. I just want to say one more thing, which is that when I talk about control, that it can also be to dominate, you know, sort of the need to dominate the other person. So intimacy, I mean, intimacy is defined differently by different people, but there's basically, I think the main feature in it is that there is an interest in the other person and an ability to put another person's needs first in a sincere way, not just to put another person's needs first in order to fool them into becoming dependent. So, there are lots of features around it, but it basically has to do with being able to put another person's needs first, being able to value another person for who they are, having a sincere interest in what a person wants or needs, and wanting to engage in that relationship with the hope and expectation that there can be reciprocity, which is to say that the other person also cares about you, so that there's a pairing of interest and a pairing of caring. I didn't intend for that to rhyme, but a pairing a pairing of caring in order to have a relationship that's mutually beneficial and mutually pleasurable. With somebody who can't engage in intimacy, they just can't even conceive of these things. There's no reason to do it, and it would be intolerable. The time taken caring about somebody else would be seen as time taken away from oneself. So they just can't. They can't, and they can't tolerate it. They can't tolerate the expectation that a person should be, that a person should expect that they would give what they would also want to receive. That's unthinkable.
I've also heard it described intimacy as into me see.
Yeah, into me see. Yeah.
And so I think I know you're going to go into this at some point, but I think with a narcissist or somebody with narcissistic behaviors or antisocial behaviors, you don't really know who they are in the relationship. And then I know we had a previous conversation about some of the interviews that you did and some of the patterns that you heard them repeating over and over and over different people.
Yeah, it was really crazy. Like I'd ask these questions. Some of them were from an interview format that we did on the intakes, because at one agency I worked at, we had people who were court mandated for services. These were perpetrators of domestic violence. At the time, the statistic was about 99% of perpetrators of domestic violence were male, and there was a small percent, 1%, who were female. Most of our clients were male, but there were a few women. And we would ask why. Well, one question would be that we'd say, you know, some people feel it's important to follow rules. How do you feel about that? And they would, I mean, one after the next, they would say, rules are for fools. It was the same sentence. And I would think, like, where do they learn this? Do they go to, like, you know, psychopath school? Like, how does everybody come out of this thinking this with the same phrase, rules are for fools? And then the other question that I would ask as part of the intake was that I would ask them, why do they would describe the behavior where they would beat up on, usually on a girlfriend, for, say, wearing a short skirt or talking to somebody else or something. And I would say, why do you feel you can do this? What makes you feel that you can beat up a person for that? And he said, they would uniformly say, because I can. And then there would be a moment, I was always sort of in shock, I guess. And then they'd say, because she lets me. And then once in a while, not 100% of the time, that was 100% of the time, because I can, because she lets me. And then sometimes they'd say, you know why? Because it's fun. And that was also very revealing. And true that for people who function this way, that's the guiding light, is that they do what they do because the person lets them. So that's an interesting insight, because there's, in their minds, there's this kind of testing period, and you say or do something And if the person puts up with it, then they know that they can do more. So not only does it, in their minds, give them permission to do more, but they now have contempt for the person who's put up with the behavior. One example, kind of seemingly innocuous example, was that I knew of, was where somebody, so these people are on a date, their first date, and the person said, in this case, it was the man who said, let's go to this restaurant. It's my favorite restaurant. It was a certain type of food. And the woman said, oh, I don't like that type of food. Let's go somewhere else. And the guy said, no, you'll see. You'll like it. And the woman said, okay. So the dynamic that was being set up was where the person number one said, this is what I want. Person number two said, not what I want. Person number one said, you'll see, you'll like it. And person number two said, okay, fine. So the dynamic is, I know what I want. The other person did stand up and say, I don't particularly want this, but the first person insisted. And then the second person said, okay. So the template is that the person will go along. Now, that was the first encounter. And I don't think people should necessarily throw people away on the basis of a first encounter. But it is something, you know, people should be taking in information. So people who are hyper-relational start out the interchange knowing that they want to be in a relationship when they don't even know the person. Whereas what I think can be more healthy, really, is that the person would want to be taking in information, but not immediately making the judgment that I want to be in this relationship. So if that first interchange where the person, in that case, the man, didn't really care about what the woman wanted and she went along with it, that would be information to hold. And then they might go forward and see if that's actually a pattern. And often it is a pattern. And if the woman in that case were to stand up for herself, that would become, you know, talk number two, where it gets into how to repel a narcissist. Because if the guy were a narcissist, he would just find that person, the woman, not interesting. He, you know, the way he would translate that she didn't do what he wanted would be, she's not that interesting, or it's really boring, we didn't have much to talk about. But he would separate. He wouldn't bother with that person.
So there's two things I want to say. First of all, going back to the example of the girlfriend wearing the short skirt, and he was, I can't remember, whatever he did was because she let him. So I think it's really important to say it's not because she's not to blame for wearing the short skirt. Like, she didn't invite that, of course, which I know you're not saying, but that's what I want to say.
No, thank you. Yeah.
The other thing, which I think I know we'll get into, is these things, as you talk about them, and I listen to the examples, and you even said it yourself, like, you don't kick somebody to the curb because of this one experience. It's very confusing and it's super complicated. And I know you will talk about this, but getting support from somebody who understands these dynamics instead of just anybody, because they're confusing.
Right. And it's interesting because I also do talks on self-care for people. And it's really important if you go to somebody, whether it's a friend or whether it's a therapist, if you go to somebody for support, I think it's important to test that person a bit. You know, like, if I went to you, Jasmine, and you said to me, how are you today? And I say, oh, I'm having a really rough day. If you say to me, really? Oh, are you okay? Do you want to talk about it? That at least tells me that you care. But you could also say, you know, you'll be fine.
Ugh, so you important. Must have some,
you know, you'll be fine. So if a person dismisses you, that doesn't make them a bad person, but it does make them somebody that you might not want to talk to, you know, that you might not want to share your disappointments with or your intimacies with, because that person has already told you that they don't have the tolerance for it or the interest or whatever it is. But that person has told you they won't be there for you. And a big problem is that hyper-relational people will often ignore the information that they have, that they really do have. Now, so that's, and that can happen with friends. Like, you can have friends, and some of your friends are there for you in certain ways that other people can't be. You might have a friend who's there for you for work advice, but not for personal advice. That's fine. So, you know, you have the relationship on the basis that it might work, but you don't want to go to the person who can't tolerate the personal stuff. It's like going to a hardware store for ice cream. You know, it's just the wrong place to go. It doesn't mean that there's not value in the hardware store or the ice cream shop, but you don't want to go to one place for the wrong thing.
This goes back to the beginning of our conversation too with diagnosing somebody with narcissistic personality disorder. I think this is a really important lesson for somebody who's that hyper-relational personality where they may look for information, this external checkbox to decide if this relationship is going to work for them. Mm-hmm. But somebody with high self-esteem would understand the way that it feels to relate to somebody who is showing them that they don't care and then make a decision whether or not they want to be in that relationship. It doesn't matter what diagnosis is present or who's right or wrong. It's, does it work for me? Yes or no?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And, but the hyper-relational person will say, oh, Jasmine, how could you be so, you know, like you're just dismissing this person. Like maybe they have a lot to offer. Well, maybe they do, but you're right. I think you're right that it's important and it's reasonable to be thinking that this is not a relationship that I want to be in or that the person really can't listen to me. Or care about how I feel.
Yes.
So, and then even if you go to a therapist, you know, there are some therapists who are not familiar with these dynamics. These dynamics, even though to you or me or anybody listening to this podcast, these dynamics are familiar and we understand them, but there are a lot of people for whom they're too subtle and they don't understand them. And so those people might say, yeah, but did you try? Did you say what you felt? Did you, and you know, even the person listening may not realize how many times they said what they felt and they just got blown off. So you can, if you go to a therapist, it's important to go to somebody who understands this dynamic because what can happen, and I don't think this is intentional, but what can happen is that sometimes the caregiver can end up colluding with the narcissist or with the narcissistic or antisocial behaviors of the other person who isn't even in the room. And sometimes the relational person will bring that other partner into therapy and sometimes therapists can end up colluding. It's really very sad.
Even in couples counseling. Yeah.
Oh yeah, for sure. Because the narcissist or antisocial person is really, really, really good at being very charming and being kind of chameleon-like. And actually they love it because they learn how to do it even better. You know, they learn a lot from the therapist. Like they're, you know, if, let's say if a therapist says, well, did you tell him how you feel? Or did you use I statements? So if you know, don't blame the person, don't call the person manipulative. But if you say, when you speak to me this way, it reminds me of how my father used to speak to me and I get very triggered. So please don't talk to me that way. In a healthy relationship, that would be great, where the other person would say, oh my gosh, I didn't realize I was triggering you. Oh my gosh, I certainly didn't intend to. I'll be careful. I will. I'll think about that. Thank you for telling me. That's a healthy relationship. But if it's a relationship with somebody who's narcissistic or antisocial, you've now given them the landscape to your psyche. You've now given them insight into how to abuse you or manipulate you. So now they know, or control you, right, and control you. So now they know, oh, okay, wow, okay, good. So if I just kind of have that edge in my voice, or if I just kind of use that word towards you, I know that that's going to make you flip out. And so then that'll be fun. And then, you know, and so then they use that information. And plus, because they're very charming and insightful, they've now engaged the therapist. So the therapist might actually end up inadvertently, certainly not on purpose, but without even realizing it, they might end up colluding with the abusive behavior. So it's really important to choose somebody, I mean, and to interview a therapist to say, do you understand these behaviors? Do you understand how it works? And it can be, as I said, the terms can be abusive behavior, but also what's called coercive control. And coercive control is a form of domestic violence, it's a non-assaultive form of domestic violence. So it's not that there's hitting going on or broken bones or black and blue marks, but there's a kind of withdrawal of human rights, really, you know, where you don't let the person have contact with their children, or you don't let them go out or have friendships or you have money, or, you know, very controlling behaviors that isolate people from their supports or from their loved ones.
I think it's really important to also talk about the level of confusion. So earlier you were talking about the covert narcissist, somebody who is a volunteer or in a house of worship or something like that, and where everybody adores this person, but then it's the people at home who can't make sense of what's happening. They don't understand. So I think also somebody going into therapy and looking for help, you know, somebody with narcissism or antisocial may represent in a certain way in therapy and be completely different outside of therapy. And it's that space. And that's the hope of this podcast, is to educate people to be able to recognize these patterns, because sometimes we don't even know what we're looking at. We don't understand what's happening.
Right. Yes, I agree. The interesting thing is that when people become aware of this, like there, you know, there's a lot of wisdom on YouTube. There's a lot of wisdom in some of the books that are being written about these things. But you can see, if you go, even if you go on YouTube, and there are some people who you may not agree with, but a remarkable number of people, and it doesn't matter if they have, some of them have PhDs, some of them don't have PhDs, some of them are sitting in their cars talking, and they have incredible wisdom, and you will hear your own words coming out of somebody else's mouth. It's a kind of shocking and gratifying experience, but it can be really shocking.
I think that's really important what you're saying, because it's so confusing. But then once you understand it, the patterns are very obvious and clear.
Like you said, when you're interviewing people, they all say
the same thing.
I know. And the thing is that, like, I was at a party once, because I was really obsessed with this question of how do they know? How do they choose you? You know, how do they pick one? I mean, they could be in a room with 100 people and there's like, boom, they know right where to go. So I was sitting at this table with three other women. And as it happened, it was like the perfect, you know, division of the profile. So one woman was, they were all sort of over around the age of 56 or 50, 55, something like that. So one woman had been, her husband had died, and she was living all alone in a large house that she still had. The second woman was married, and liked to travel on her own. And the third woman was divorced and was looking for somebody. So the second woman, the one who was married and liked to travel, she was talking about how she was going to go away on this trip to another country. And it was very adventurous. She wanted to do it herself. She was going to, you know, figure out how to do it and figure out her own travel guide. And she had, you know, she had the finances to do it, and she was going to do it alone. The first woman, the one who was widowed, she said, "Oh, I don't think I could ever do something like that alone. I would want to have somebody go with me. I'm living all alone in my house, my big house. I'm all alone all the time. I have the money. I would bring somebody else with me. I'd love to find somebody else who would love to do a trip like that. But most people don't have the time. They can't go away. They, you know, they have jobs, and I can never find anybody." And then the third woman said something about how she would go on a trip, but she would never go alone, and she would want to be in something that would be all set up by some business. So I'm sitting there, I'm thinking, oh wow, okay. So if I were a psychopath or a narcissist or something, and if I wanted to find somebody that I could control, I'm going with number one. That is to say, she was sitting immediately to my left. I'm going with that one because she's just told me that she's lonely, that she's alone. She's been alone for a long time. She's got the money. She has a big house. There's a lot to work with there if somebody's a psychopath or even a narcissist who wants to get all the attention of a person. It would be really easy to isolate her and to take advantage of her. So the point is that people actually go the same way that the transactional people will tell you, they'll tell you who they are. They'll say, "You're too good for me," or "I'm not good enough for you." In the same way that they tell people, also the relational people go around telling people too. And the relational people really almost self-identify as targets. You know, they make it quite easy for people. And then if it weren't all that easy, then the next thing is that once they test you, you know, they see if you'll go on a date somewhere you don't want to go, or that they'll do something or, you know, do or say something that's provocative and you don't speak up, then they not only know that they can proceed with that behavior, but they now have contempt for you and they actually believe that you deserve to be abused.
Can you say that again?
That not only do they know that they can do what they want but that they have contempt for you, and they believe that you deserve to be abused.
Can you say more about that?
Yeah, it's an interesting turning point, I think, in any relationship, because it all depends on, it can be different for different people, but once the person knows that you feel comfortable, that's when they start to slam you. And it can be anything. It can be something simple. It can be, you know, like you're sitting watching television and you just say, honey, could you bring me a glass of water on your way back from the bathroom or something? And just, it's just that sense of that you expect it, that they resent, and that then they'll start to push back and make you very uncomfortable. But by that time, they know that you're invested. It can be different things for different people. It can be that you've told them that you love them, or it can be just that it could be when some people, they wait till you're married. And then the moment you're married, that's when the stuff starts to hit the fan. Or it can be when you start a family, or, you know, it's different in different situations. But at some point, there's a turning point, and they know that they can then take advantage of you. Before that, there will be a testing period. I always am curious about a person's first date, because my feeling is that there's usually something, usually the information is there on a first date. It might be a more subtle form of the relation, of the information, but usually that information is there. It's just that the relational person, first of all, is reluctant to give up on this prospect of a relationship. And also because of what we both talked about, which is that you don't just throw someone to the curb because they don't measure up perfectly on a first date. But when you consider that on a first date, that's somebody's best shot, you know, that's their best behavior usually. So if a person does something strange or problematic on a first date, it actually is pretty meaningful, because when you consider that that's their best shot, you know, like if you go on a date and let's say the person is mean to the waiter or mean to the bus person, you know, who like spilled water maybe as they poured a glass of water. You could say that the rationalization would be to say that they were the excuse that the relational person will make is, oh, well, he was really nervous. He wanted to impress me and he got really upset that the bus boy, in that case, it was a man, spilled the water. But you know what, really yelling at somebody, putting them down like that publicly, there's really no excuse for it. And it ends up in that one case where that was an example that ended up being quite prophetic in terms of what the relationship was to be, where the person really would look for opportunities to express rage, but blame it on somebody else's shortcoming. You know, they could make a small mistake and it would in their mind be a reason for rage. Then the relational person might try to revisit it and say, let's talk about it, like what was going on. And then the rage starts again. So the rage becomes almost a kind of training method, the way you would train a dog, you know, to heal. This would be the way that somebody trains another person not to speak up. So they test you along the way. As I say, I think it starts at the very beginning, but certainly early on. They test you because they don't want to invest all that much time or energy into you if you are going to stand up for yourself.
I think that's a really important point, that the test will be there from the very beginning, because yeah, it's a function of they have to test you to see.
That's right.
If
that's right.
So the other thing I think we talked about before we started recording that I think is important is the hyper-relational person will project their intentions onto the other person. So let's say something does happen and it's dangerous because they're blind to the behavior, because they're like, I would never do that. They would never do that. But that's not always true.
Right, right. There's a lot of projection that goes on. So let's say if I'm a relational person and if I were to yell at you, the only reason I would yell at you would be because I was upset. Right. I mean, that's why I would yell at you. So if a person, I'm in this relationship and the person yells at me, I'm assuming that they must be upset, but that's not actually the case. Because I'm projecting, you know, and the way you hear it a lot, which worries me a lot, is when people say, people struggling with this, people struggling with, they're not struggling. They know what they're doing. I mean, I've interviewed them and they'll say that they are having fun with it. They'll go to the therapist with their partner and they'll just kind of, you know, fool the therapist, or that, oh, I had that quote for you from this movie called I, Psychopath, which I'll read. But they know what they're doing and they're having fun doing it because they know what the other person is thinking, that the relational person is thinking, oh, there's a miscommunication or they did something wrong. And one of the things that part of this pattern is that people love to do is it's called stonewalling, where they just don't talk to you. And they love it because it's what they call minimal input for maximal output. So all they have to do is clam up, and the relational person will become very upset, and they'll say, "What's the matter? You're not yourself. Did I do something wrong? Tell me what it is. I'll apologize." Or they just do apologize for something that they didn't even do, and they just start sputtering. You know, the relational person just is beside themselves, and they can't tolerate this lack of input and lack of love from the other person. There's this movie, it's called I, Psychopath, and you can see it online. This guy named Sam Vaknin, who is a self-proclaimed narcissist, he says, if you displease the narcissist or the psychopath, he will F you over, if only for the kick of it. And then he said, this is talking about how he would upset people. He goes, many systems in the body go haywire with the session of bullying, over the session, and especially after the session is over. So what bullies usually do, they start and stop. That achieves the maximal physiological arousal and the maximum physiological arousal and the maximal stress syndrome. And this is the great secret of bullying. Never overdo it. Small doses. The victim will do the rest.
What you're talking about is so important. So there's two things that I think are important. The hyper-relational person will believe that the narcissistic person or the antisocial person is hurting. Like you said, they'll think it's authentic that they're in pain. Mm-hmm. And so they'll often blame themselves because it's so confusing that even though they're the victim, they'll take on the role of apologizing because they feel like they've hurt this person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
The other part that I think is really important is somebody who is skilled, I guess I should say, at doing this, like that bullying piece that you're mm-hmm. talking about. Mm-hmm. If an outsider was looking in on this dynamic, the victim may be the one who's yelling and looks right. like they're the problem.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right. And that's why I was saying it's so important to be talking to people who understand this dynamic, because to someone who doesn't understand the dynamic, just the words on the paper or, you know, looking at it as if it were a movie, they might not, they probably won't pick up on it. And this is happening in courtrooms or with lawyers and, you know, people who are very well educated and very smart in general, but who may not understand this dynamic. So that someone who looks as if, from the outside, looks as if they're being, quote, dramatic or overreacting, but they're not overreacting. It's that they are reacting with the knowledge of what has preceded it. So a person can threaten another person and inform the second person that they will do terrible things if the second person doesn't do what they want. At that point, the second person doesn't need to be yelled at or threatened in a big way. They just need to have a side glance come their way, and they, you know, just the look on the person's face. This happens a lot in mediation for custody battles or, you know, divorce cases, dissolutions, where the relationships are very intimate in the worst sense. Without the reciprocity, but the people know each other very well. And it doesn't take a big statement. It just takes a side glance for someone to know that a fight will ensue if they don't go along with what the person wants. Yeah, so that can be somebody observing would say, well, honestly, I think you were the one who was overreacting. But that's because they don't know the whole history. I want to also right. say that we were talking about the therapy context another question is, why doesn't the person leave? And my feeling is that there's a complex dynamic that goes on. But I just want to say, first of all, that for, you know, people look and they say, well, why doesn't she leave? She should just leave. And even therapists sometimes will encourage people to leave, but that it's, and it might be healthier in the end for someone to be able to separate, but it's also really important to understand that that is the most dangerous time, is when a person leaves. So it has to be done with a lot of forethought and a lot of understanding of what can happen. But going back to the question of why does somebody stay? So if there are all these problems, why do they stay? And I think that it's a very, very complex dynamic, but basically it kind of boils down to three things. One is that there's what's called confirmatory bias. And that's basically the science of first impressions. And basically what that means is that when you meet somebody, the first impression is very compelling, and it really does stay with people, even to the point where if a person is presented with evidence to the contrary, they won't necessarily believe it when the first impression has been powerful. Then with the having established the first impression, there's intermittent reinforcement, which is kind of which is the dynamic that keeps people going to gambling casinos even when they lose all their money. So what that means is that intermittently the person will get what they need. So there's this dynamic where somebody meets somebody, there's a confirmatory bias, and then, as we said, the person, the narcissistic or antisocial person, the transactional person, starts to withdraw the love or begins to manipulate more, and then the person will withdraw, the relational person will withdraw, and then the transactional person will come back and they'll say they're sorry or whatever it is that they have to do to re-engage the person. That's often referred to as the cycle of violence, that there's a cycle in that, where there's what they call the honeymoon period, and then there's the violence, and then there's the withdrawal, and then there's the apology, and then there's the violence again. Or then the honeymoon period recurs, and then there's the violence. And then the third piece of it is investment, which is that for a lot of people, if they the more they invest in a relationship, the more they value it, and the less likely they are to walk away from it. So once the person is invested, and that can be different for different people, it can be that they've passed the third date, they just feel like that's now it's become comfortable, or it could be that they've had sex with them, or it could be that they've kissed them, or it could be that they've said they love you, or it could be having a child. It can be whatever it is for the person. Once they've invested in it, they're not likely to walk away. And the transactional person knows that. They're very intuitive about transaction and what when a person is invested. So it's those three things, confirmatory bias, intermittent reinforcement, and the investment that keeps the person there. And to get them to leave, I think really takes, sometimes it takes understanding what's going. What often happens in these relationships is that the narcissistic person will keep the relational person engaged until the transactional person is ready to leave, at which point he or she makes it impossible for the relational person to stay. So the relational person thinks that they're leaving. The relational person might think, oh, I left that, you know, I did this or that. But really what happened was that the transactional person made it impossible to stay. So once the transactional person had their next target in sight and they had already kind of engaged with them, they get the sense that it's a safe bet, that's when they make it impossible. They start to up the behavior, increase the behaviors, and make staying just intolerable. But sometimes they will actually dump the person. Sometimes they'll just say, you know, they'll be, because they might enjoy the cruelty in it. So they might just dump the person, say something about ending the relationship. But that's basically the pattern. And then in between, you know, so we also talked about the idea that there's this, the pattern that will occur is that there's first they identify their target, and then they idealize the target. That's the love bombing. Then they devalue the target, where they will do these things where they sort of make life miserable. But that's a very long period. They'll devalue, and then they'll idealize to reengage, and then they'll dump or dismiss the target or get the target to leave. That's the pattern.
Yeah, and this is another part of the patterns that are so clear, but it's really hard to see them, especially the confirmatory bias, right? Like, oh, but you know, and I think we talked about this before, but most of the people, you know, there's a higher percentage of male narcissism. And so when we say he, she, we're just generalizing based on experience.
Right. Well, also on statistics. I mean, statistically speaking, it's interesting because people think of women as being narcissistic because women are encouraged to think about their appearances and women wear more makeup and all that kind of thing. But in fact, statistically anyway, there are more men who are narcissists. And that might be because society encourages men or creates a kind of, one could say, certain advantages in life so that they are expected. They expect certain things that that women might not expect as a matter of course. So statistically speaking, and I think that it's probably underreported, or underidentified, but statistically. So yes, using he has a rationale behind it. I try not to, just because I'm sure that there are men who are listening to this who feel that they've been on the receiving end.
I had a thought a second ago that mm-hmm. I wanted to say about the confusion that happens. So there's the confirmatory bias. So you know, there could be these grand romantic gestures in the beginning of a relationship. Mm-hmm. And then when the devalue process happens, it can be really hard to realize what's actually happening. Cause there could be one moment where like, oh, maybe there's this small experience where he brings flowers or does something that seems like we can like hang our coat on that as like, mm-hmm. oh, this is validation that things are okay and right. not missing the bigger picture, which is why for anybody listening, if any of this is triggering you, and I would imagine that it is because a lot of what we're talking about could be normal, it could be happening, but it also could be a problem. I would really encourage you to educate yourself. Like Fran was talking about YouTube videos, like these patterns do not lie. They are very clear if you know what you're looking at.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. That's the other thing is that it's so confusing and they keep thinking, the relational person will keep saying, but it was so good in the start if I could just get back to that. And what I try to help them understand is that there never was that behavior in this. That behavior in the start was artifice. It wasn't the real person. So this idea of let's get back to where we were, you will never get back to where you were because that was a false impression. And that's really hard for a relational person to understand or to accept because they wouldn't do that. You know, they wouldn't just, I mean, on a first date, the relational person is doing their best and they think that that's what the other person is doing. They have no concept of how extreme the artifice can be. They simply have no concept. And I would even say to people, you don't want to have the concept because you don't want to be that person, but you just have to believe that it's not real. You know, once you get enough evidence to show that it really wasn't genuine, that's when you should run for the hills because it's only going to get worse.
Yeah.
But so then I think a really important question is why you? And I think that it's really important to understand the concept of grooming. Whenever I, like, even when I talk to people and they say, no, 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 there wasn't this, there was nothing. The person was always in a good relationship up to then. And I'm like, there has to have been some grooming because otherwise anybody wouldn't stay. I mean, you just wouldn't stay and tolerate the behavior. So there has to be some, or I mean, 9,999 times out of 10,000, there was some kind of grooming process that went on. And there's a large range of things that can be, but somehow along the way, usually in childhood, you were taught to put other people's needs before yours and to ignore your gut, you know, to ignore your response system. Now, it could be that you learn to rationalize and excuse the bad behavior of other people. So the question becomes, where does that happen? And it can be that that a person was raised by a parent with narcissism. Or it could be that you were raised in a family that had particular challenges. You know, maybe a parent had an illness or another person, a sibling or somebody might have had a physical illness where all the money and attention had to go toward that. It could be that there was substance use or abuse in the family that led to very erratic behaviors that you had to learn to live with. It could be a good thing. It could be that one of the people in the family was a prodigy of some sort and that all the energies went into helping that person develop their talent or buying a musical instrument that was very expensive and so that the person could excel. It could be that you came from a family that moved here from another country. And this happens a lot where the children are actually better at speaking the language than the parents. So the children are the ones who have to go out and talk to the landlord or talk to the school system or, you know what I mean? Like to take care of things that are really very adult, either for him or for the child themselves or for their siblings or on behalf of the parents. So, but the point is that they take on a role from a young age where they learn to put other people's needs first and they learn to take care of other people and ignore their own needs. It's the ignoring their own needs part. I mean, you can take care of other people, but if the family system or the larger system still encourages you to be a part of one of the beneficiaries of the actions, that can be saving. But if you have learned to ignore your own needs, then what happens is, that's actually it's kind of your talent, you know, that you can function under such difficult circumstances and function on behalf of so many people. So then when you find yourself in a relationship, your talent is that you can put your own needs aside and that you can, you know, think of what somebody else needs. And you probably become very intuitive about other people's needs. So that it's very common for people to talk about how they understand when somebody else is angry before that person even knows that they're angry. And so your talent, as you see it, is that you can help people before they even know that they need help. But the downside of it is that you've learned to put your own needs aside, which in and of itself doesn't have to be bad. But if you learn to put your own needs aside to the point where you're being harmed, then it's problematic.
And I think it's really important to jump in here too and say, I know so many parents, there's so much guilt for failing your children. And so I think it's really important to just say that, like, no parent is perfect. No parent is going to create a perfect environment for their child.
Right. Yeah, that's true. I mean, no parent is perfect and every relationship is unique. So, but there can be, and I also think that no upbringing is perfect. And so in the same way that we all have predispositions to anything, you know, you can have a medical predisposition to diabetes and or to heart disease or any number of things. And so if that's the case, it really becomes one's own responsibility as an adult to begin to, you know, examine that and see it and try to offset whatever those dispositions, whether they're genetic dispositions or social dispositions, but whatever those vulnerabilities might be. So it is important, but it's also important to understand that, you know, you've taken on this pattern of putting other people's needs first to your own detriment. I think it's great to put other people's needs first. I think that's part of what it means to be in a loving relationship. But it's just that other piece where it's to your own detriment and where the person doesn't care. You know, you can talk to them about trying to correct the behaviors, but they're not looking to correct it. They're looking to take advantage of it.
And another part I think is really important is if you question that or if you speak up in a lot of these dysfunctional systems, you'll be punished for asking for your needs to be met.
Yes. Yes. And the punishment can be anything from withdrawal, where just, you know, the person just won't talk to you for a couple of days, or it can be a beating. I mean, it can, or anything in between. You know, these things can be really unpredictable and quite devastating. But again, as you said, the relational person would be inclined to think that it has to be for good reason, because they wouldn't do that thing unless it were for good reason. And what they're not really taking in is that in these relationships, which are by definition problematic, so I'm not saying that it happens in all relationships, but I'm talking about these particular relationships that are problematic, the responses are not on the same basis that they would be for a relational person, which is to say they are of a transactional nature in order to get you to do what they want you to do.
Yeah. So back to the grooming piece.
Yeah. The grooming. So the grooming can you know, there are theories of personality around that. And, there's a woman named Alice Miller. She wrote a book called The Drama of the Gifted Child that describes how what she calls a gifted child, I would call it a burdened child, but anyway, the child that is in that case is raised by a narcissistic parent, and the child learns to put whereas the normal healthy dyad between a parent and child would be for the parent to anticipate the child's needs. In this case, it's reversed, and the child anticipates the parent's needs and becomes very good at learning to do that. There's also a woman, Sandra L. Brown. She writes about women who love psychopaths. And what I thought was interesting about her work is that she points out that a lot of the women who engage in these relationships, you know, it's not that they're weak or, you know, undeveloped people. They're people who are, like, often really very professional, very smart, very well educated. The problem or the weakness, I don't want to call it the weakness, but the issue is that these women have a very strong sense of values that end up getting abused, which is to say the values that they carry, which are things like compassion, intelligence, fairness, empathy, responsibility, accountability, all of these things, they hold these values highly and they apply them to themselves. So when somebody treats them badly, They ask themselves, am I being compassionate enough? Am I showing enough empathy? Am I being accountable for my behavior? Because a big thing that people will say is, well, I wouldn't have to do this. I wouldn't have to hit you if you did what I said, or I wouldn't have to yell at you if you weren't such an idiot. And so then the person will be thinking, did I say something wrong? Was I an idiot? And while you're thinking, you know, while in the name of responsibility, you're thinking this through, this other person is running circles around you because you're reflecting as one would, but in a situation where it's not to your advantage, where, you know, it's with a person who isn't treating you responsibly. There's also a guy called Ross Rosenberg. He talks about the human magnet syndrome and self-love deficit disorder. I mean, all these people are really interesting. There's a guy named Jerry Wise who talks about low self-differentiation or overanalysis, where you're doing too much. So he almost says that if you look at a relationship and if you look at how hard you're working versus how hard the other person's working, if you're doing more than 50% of the work, or let's just say, to, you know, I'm not saying it's exactly 50%, but really, if you're overworking, you're doing too much. If you're the one thinking, why isn't this relationship working? Why this? Why that? Why you're analyzing it and the other person's just kind of doing their thing, that you're probably doing too much. There's also childhood emotional neglect, the idea that if you were neglected in childhood, that you would have adjusted to that level of neglect and you might not expect fair treatment as an adult. There are lots of attachment theories. And then there's also fairly new concept of complex PTSD, or CPTSD is called. So in general, when you talk about PTSD, you're talking about some event that might have occurred in your life where you feared for your safety or for your health or for somebody close to you, like a parent or someone close to you. So, but now there's this concept where if you might not have had to have had one event that was particularly frightening, but that if you were neglected, generally speaking, let's say throughout childhood, so there was no one event, but you had the recurring experience of feeling that you were never safe or that nobody was watching out for you, that could cause you to seek security in places where it's not to be found, which is to say in relationships where people just aren't going to be there for you, but you need to believe it. So you seek it out beyond people.
Or drugs or alcohol or something like that. I like to describe it as in two ways. So often when I'm working with people, it's hard to identify a traumatic event. And so it's this idea of these little paper cuts that happened over and over again. Wouldn't be able to identify necessarily as a traumatic event, but because they happen so much. And then also the important thing about neglect, I think I like to describe it as it's so hard to identify because it doesn't leave a bruise. It's hard to identify something that wasn't there.
That's right. That's right. Right. It's like to identify the negative, you know, to identify the thing that didn't happen.
Yeah.
And also because for different people, it's different things. So, you know, one child might be I used to love to read biographies. So you read biographies and one child that was neglected ended up seeing it as, oh, great. Wow. So I can do my own thing. And they went off and did all sorts of stuff or got into their little world and wrote books and became a great author. You know, people can process the experience very differently. But the thing that's important is how each person does process it. I mean, another thing is that when sometimes, you know, this also comes under how people identify you as a good target is this tendency to dissociate. So if somebody yells at you, that is to say, we all have this fight or flight response biologically, that if somebody treats you badly or if you're in the forest and a wild animal comes upon you, there's the fight or flight that you can either fight the animal or you try to run away. There's also a third one that's identified, which is to freeze. So where you might just think that if you just stand still, that they won't see you. So that's when it's one event. But if you've learned over time, if this has been happening, so part of what happens in your brain, by the way, and in your body is that if it's a one-time event, your body fills with cortisol and adrenaline so that you can run away. But those things, cortisol, adrenaline, those are toxic if they're experienced long-term without, you know, unmitigated. So if you're living in a relationship where you're always being attacked, basically these toxins are being released in your body without any mitigation. And then you're basically kind of being like your brain and your organs are being pickled in toxins. So it really becomes sort of an ongoing state. But one of the ways that they can identify you is that when they do present these challenges is that people will sort of dissociate. It's that freeze piece where you don't respond. You don't say, don't talk to me that way. You don't say, how dare you? Or, you know, I'm leaving. You just sort of dissociate and just kind of like stand there or almost watch the event as if you were watching from outside. You know, that's also something that people are very quick to pick up on.
We could go in 1,000 different directions with all of these topics, which I wish we had time for today, but we don't. But yeah, all those books, amazing resources. I also love the work of Gabor Mate. He's a psychiatrist. Uh-huh. Brilliant. The things that he talks about. I also think there's an important piece when we're talking about relationships being 50-50. There's a part of how our society is changing and how women are in the workplace. Like there's this whole different place we could go where, you know, 50 years ago was a completely 100 years ago was a completely different balance of responsibilities or who right. took care of the home. And so there's so many different points, but for moving along with this, I think the next part, tell me if I'm wrong, but the next part would be how to repel a narcissist. Is that the next point?
Yeah. So how to repel a narcissist. So that's not to be confused with how to make a narcissist into a good person or how to appease a narcissist or...
Can you give us a lesson on how to make a narcissist a good person?
No, there is no lesson on how to make a narcissist a good person or to make the narcissist into the person you'd want him or her to be. Because, by the way, narcissism... So we're talking about relationships and these are very important, you know, for each person, how it works. And I would say that if a person, you know, that... not everybody's going to be perfect. And if you decide that this relationship is not good for you to be, that you might make your choice to get out. But narcissism itself, you know, has some very important and very positive benefits to society. For instance, for someone to think in terms of like one day everybody's going to have their own telephone. Like who would have thought 100 years ago that everybody would have their own telephone? But somebody had the idea, and probably at the time people said, you're out of your mind. That's not going to happen. But, you know, I don't know who this person was who like put this plan in motion, and it could have, and the person could have been narcissistic enough to think that his or her plan, I'm guessing it was a man, but that his or her plan was workable, or the idea of getting somebody to the moon, or yeah, you know, there are lots of things that I think we could all, people who are highly, highly relational, we can all benefit from having some narcissistic characteristics. We want to have what's called healthy narcissism. And even for some people to get these ideas across, it might be even more than healthy narcissism. They might be impossible to live with, but in terms of inventions or in terms of creativity, they might make real contributions to society. So it's really important. This is a very complex topic. And really the purpose of this, as I understand it, the purpose of this podcast is to help people who are involved in detrimental relationships with people who have these characteristics and how to help them see it and identify it and identify their own characteristics. So I don't want to be knocking narcissism in and of itself, you know, like blanketly in and of itself. There can be some really important pieces to understand.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And I think you said this before, maybe earlier, just that you don't want to identify it as a good or a bad person. So my right. comment that how do you make a narcissist a good person?
Yeah.
We're talking about in relationship. And I don't know about you, but I have not met anybody in a relationship with a narcissist who feels good and happy and peaceful. And so maybe they exist. But the point of this is to invite people to take care of themselves.
Right,
and
right.
understand what works for them.
Right. And some people, there can be some people who are happy in those relationships. Those are usually people who crave the characteristics and who get a lot of secondary gain. I mean, you get invited to a lot of parties if you like parties, and you get a lot of acknowledgement if you're married to somebody or, you know, partnered with somebody who's very well respected or famous or whatever it might be. So there can be people who would say that they're perfectly happy in these relationships. And it's not for me to challenge that. I'm only talking about, and I think you too, we're talking about how the people who are not happy in the relationships and who are asking, how did this happen and what can I do?
Right. It's, and as you said, it's very complex.
Yeah. Yeah. So how to repel a narcissist. I mean, the short answer really in one word basically is just, well, two words, is to be yourself. that if the whole idea is that what they're craving is for you to admire them, then if you are just going to be yourself and not admire them, they will not be interested and you will repel them. It's kind of like, when I say repel, I mean to continue with the magnet idea, is that it'll be like putting two magnets, trying to put two magnets together of the same pole, and they won't meet. So if you're just yourself, and if the person says, let's go to this restaurant, and you say no, and they say, you'll see, you'll like it. And you say, you know, why would you want me to go to a restaurant where I don't like this food? I don't get it. Like, I know there's another place down the street. Let's go to that one. At that moment, that person might still go to dinner with you, might pay the bill if that's the way you set it up, but they are not going to invite you out again. You know, so just being yourself is really the thing. But that's not enough. You know, a lot of people who engage in these relationships, first of all, have to ask why. Why would I want to repel a narcissist? And I would say to them that it's actually being in a relationship like this, if it's stressing you out, can really have very serious effects on the body. There has been research on the idea that stress can cause autoimmune disease, things like rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, psoriasis, Crohn's disease, celiac disease. And there's also research that stress can kill. There's also research that says that stress can be positive for you. So I don't mean that blanketly stress can kill. But I am saying that that there's reason to believe that if these relationships are, that these relationships can be quite medically, can have a medical effect. As I was saying, if you're constantly, if your body is constantly discharged or triggering because of a fear response, if it's triggering toxins in the body, then you're basically remaining with that imbalance in your body over a period of years. So it can be really bad. And then also for the family, it can be really bad. I mean, for children having to live in that environment. In terms of quality of life, so that's a kind of biological thing. In terms of quality of life, it can be very problematic. You can have problems with work. Children can be failing in school, or they have difficulty concentrating. They get very confused, and you think that there's something wrong with you, which is very difficult, if not impossible, very difficult to live with, and it can lead to mental health issues. So some of these issues, being in relationship like this, can cause anxiety disorders, depression. That's something that a lot of people experience, is sort of generalized anxiety. They don't even know what it is. That's like, nothing particularly happens. They'll say, there's nothing particularly going on, but I'm anxious, I'm coming out of my skin. And they'll express feelings of depression, just sort of low grade or high grade, but ongoing, unmitigating depression that's not even responsive to medication or to therapy. People become hypervigilant. They become very agitated. They can have anxious and avoidant, what are called attachment styles. They can be very distrustful of others. They can feel sort of paranoid. Their physical health can be affected, like insomnia. You know, sleep, lack of sleep in and of itself is enough to meet medical necessity for insurance companies. It's a very important physical problem if somebody's not getting enough sleep. And then somatic symptoms like lowered immune system, high blood pressure, diabetes, heart disease, all of these things can be associated. Somatic symptoms like abdominal pain, back pain, tremors. It's really, it affects you in so many ways to be involved in relationships where people are suffering like this. And each time you repeat these behaviors or these dynamics, it sort of reinforces in the brain, the pathways in the brain. So as I said, repelling a narcissist, it's not about appeasing them. It's not about getting along better. It's about really, and it's not changing them into becoming a more relational version of themselves, which is what a lot of relational people have trouble with. They insist on believing that if they just communicated a little better, if they just explain it differently, that the person will want to change, if for no other reason than to maintain the relationship. But that's not how it works, unfortunately.
So going back to this idea that you can be happy in a relationship, there are people who can be happy. If you're somebody who's looking for like a mutually reciprocal, intimate, partnership, you're not likely to find it here.
No, I agree. But so one of the things that I've said to people is, is if you just, so the real answer is just be yourself. But if you need to break it down, then, you know, it's important for a person to define what they value and to begin to act with authenticity around that, to maintain healthy boundaries and to insist on healthy boundaries. You know, if somebody makes a promise to say, you know, I expect you to keep this promise. And whereas before they might have said, well, you're not going to change the narcissist, but that would be if the relational person needs to go through this act with the narcissist to see if they'll change, then these would be the kinds of things they do. They wouldn't accept the, oh, well, I said I promised, but things change. They wouldn't accept that. They'd say, no, I expect you to keep a promise. And then to observe what happens, like to be willing to sort of pull yourself back and just see what happens, like see if the person keeps their promise or see if the person actually does what they say they'll do or whatever that might be, but to pull back and just observe and be willing to take in the information as if you were watching it on a movie and writing down what happened, not to carry the emotional baggage for the relationship. Like relational people tend to sort of take that on as their responsibility, just to be the ones that they're almost like the person who watches over the relationship and keeps it safe. So it might be that it's time to not carry that emotional baggage for the relationship and to not take on more than their fair share, which let's just call it 50%. I'm not saying it has to be exactly that. Even if you call it 60%, chances are the relational person is taking on 75, 80, 90% of the responsibility for that. So we didn't really talk about the concept of mirroring, but the relational person is often very good at mirroring. Well, narcissists can be too, in the sense when they're trying to engage you. But what I'm saying is that the relational person can be very good at understanding what the person wants, you know, to agree with the person or to make things move easily. But if you want to repel a narcissist, all you have to do, or one of the things you can do, is to purposefully withhold. Again, it comes from be yourself. So let's say if somebody asks you to do something or asks you for information, let's say, for instance, you're starting to date somebody and they ask you for your last name and you don't want to give your last name, you just don't give your last name. Often what somebody will do is they'll say, well, my last name is Smith. What's yours? Because now they've revealed something. So they expect you to do the same. Because they know that you believe in reciprocity. They don't believe in it, but they know you do. They're very adept at knowing what your value system is and working it against you. So if you don't want to give your last name or you don't want to give your phone number or you don't want to give your personal email address, you don't have to. And then you can see what happens because they won't like it. And then they might try to guilt you out. Like they might say, you know, I really find like I'm doing everything in this relationship and you're not. It's a complete, totally turning the tables on what's actually going on. But with a relational person, it might very well work. And you just have to stick to your guns and know what you are doing and be willing to have that person walk away from you. Because relational people can also be very, I mean, these are such broad statements. But what's interesting is that when you talk to people about it, it tends to be, it's pretty consistently valid. So in general, relational people tend to be very invested in being wanted because the relationship holds such high value. So it could feel like a bit of a slap in the face if the person actually walks away because you stood up for what you wanted. The relational person wants the person to think, oh, she stood up for what she wanted. That's good. I admire this person. But that's not often how it works. It'll be more like, well, no, I'm gone. I'm out.
This is so complicated too, because it goes back to the programming too. So if somebody's programmed, like you said, the relationship is really important. They get their self-worth externally potentially. Mm-hmm. And so if that person leaves, then it means that I'm not worthy instead of holding on to themselves. Mm-hmm. The other thing I see a lot is the word selfish. If uh-huh. you are programmed to not put yourself first or yeah. put other people's needs first, there's this huge fear of being selfish if I have any boundaries or care about myself mm-hmm. at all. Even I'm narcissistic if I think about myself at all. And that's right. Just not true.
No, it's not. And that's where, you know, where at the very beginning, we were talking about what's referred to as healthy narcissism, where, I mean, really, I think if the word narcissism is used, that's already not healthy, but we do talk about healthy narcissism, and that's where we all want to be admired. We all want, you know, we want people to think that we're nice or attractive or smart or, what, you know, fill in the blank, whatever your value system is, but that can be used against you. So as I said about that idea of values, you know, that people value compassion or selflessness or whatever, and likewise, selfish is something that that can be used against you. So while the person says you're so selfish, you're thinking, am I being selfish? Am I being unfair? And meanwhile, they're, as I said, running circles around you. So yeah, so it's really, you know, it's really important to like open up your sense of where this can all go and how some, and sort of observe. Like another thing, you can even do stuff. It's interesting. You can like, if you watch TV or watch a movie with somebody, characters in those, in these plays or in these dramas are kind of like a Rorschach test, you know, where you can, how a person responds to a character. So you might have some characters who are, I would say, horrible, you know, like mean and cruel, but you could be watching this movie with somebody and they could say, wow, but yeah, you know, I really admire how strong they are. And you're like, what? This person, you know, like you might see them as I said, being cruel, but someone else might see them as being strong. Now, it's up to you what you want to do with that information. I would say that it might be an insight into the fact that you might have a different value system, and that it could be really useful information, because you could then say, okay, well, if you think this person is strong, if you admire this person, that to me is problematic. But it's great information. And the best moment, by the way, is when the person actually reveals themselves, because the confusion in all of this is that the person, the narcissist or antisocial person, that these people, they're so confusing. They know when they've gone too far, and then they pull back, and then, you know, it's not really clear. And there's what's called gaslighting. Excuse me, we didn't really go into that. But gaslighting is where a person convinces you that you're crazy. The term comes from a movie from, I don't know if it was the 1940s or 50s, called Gaslight, with Ingrid Bergman and Charles Boyer, I think. And where the guy makes the woman think that she's crazy by turning the light up and down. So that happens a lot. And
well, the point of the movie too is that he's hiding something and he doesn't want her to know what he's hiding. And so instead of being open or accountable for his behavior, instead he manipulates reality so that she thinks that she's crazy.
Yeah, I thought it was actually that he was trying to get something. He was trying to find something out, and he could only find it if he drove her crazy. But whichever
there's actually is. There's actually two different movies. I think one of them was in the 40s and one of them was in the 50s. But I think this was the earlier one. I think he had murdered somebody. And so I think that's really important in the world of like addiction or something too, this gaslighting concept where instead of being accountable, somebody will like make you question reality, which happens all the time. Mm-hmm. And so like, if you're wondering if something feels off, it might be off.
Yeah, exactly. So, but you can actually, you know, you can find different ways. So the problem, as I said, you want to repel a narcissist, just be yourself. But if you're somebody who's in this process of having to understand it better, or asking the question, why would I want to repel this person? Then you need more information. So the question becomes, how do you get more information? And part of how you can get this information is by using all the information that's right in front of you, because it's usually there. And one of the things that I was starting to say is that the moment when they actually reveal themselves can be so horrifying, and yet it's a wonderful moment. I mean, I hope people will take it for what it's, for the value that it offers, because up until that point, they've been gaslighting and they've been going back and forth and making you think you're crazy. So you haven't ever really felt that you had a clear picture. But if the person actually shows who they are, you should be, instead of being horrified and, you know, and rejecting the moment, if possible, it's good to embrace that moment, because now finally you're seeing what's been going on. Finally.
And that may be the real person that you're in a relationship with and you just never saw it.
Right. Exactly. Up to then, they've been confusing you. They've been saying that you're the one, you're being silly, you're being stupid, or, you know, if you understood, or if you were smarter, I wouldn't have to do this, or if you hadn't talked to me that way, or, you know what I mean? They've been very confusing. But if you actually get to the moment where you can see that how they've been behaving, or if you begin to test for the reciprocity. Like, this was something that's interesting when I spoke about it. I gave examples of ways to test people, and the attendees at the talk, they were all like, but that's so manipulative, which I thought was interesting, because really what it was doing what normal people do in relationships in order to discern whether they want to be in a relationship with someone. So for instance, you can test a person for reciprocity. So a good way to test a person for reciprocity, I think, is to ask the narcissist to do something for you that the narcissist asked you to do, you did, and the narcissist liked. So because if the narcissist asked you to do it, that means that the person acknowledges the value of it. The fact that you did it sets the stage for reciprocity. And the fact that the narcissist liked it shows that it, again, had value. So if you, like, it can be anything. It can be, as I said, it can be asking somebody to bring you back a glass of water, you know, on their way back from somewhere. Like, they're already up. All you need to do is get a glass of water. Or give me a massage, or massage my hand or my feet, or could you get me my keys? You know, it doesn't have to be a big deal. The question is whether the reciprocity will be honored. Or you can ask the narcissist to do something like what you did voluntarily and the person liked. So again, the fact that they liked it reinforces the goodness of the act. They didn't ask for it, but you did it voluntarily. And again, it could be the same thing. It could be bringing the water, or it could be, you know, doing the person a favor, bringing them a snack from the store, whatever it might be. But the point being that it's already, the template has been set. It's been shown that the person liked it, that there was value to it. And if you ask the person to do the same thing, you might also ask the person to do something for you that you know they may not want to do, but you still are asking them on the basis of, if you love me, it's not that big a deal. I'm not talking about a trip to Europe or a computer, or I'm not talking about anything of value. I'm talking about something that costs nothing that you can ask. And when I posed this to these people, they were like, but that's so manipulative. And I was like, really? Because that's part of the thing, is that this is what people do. This is what healthy people do, is they see, is a person willing to be nice to me? That's really all we're talking about. Now you can go further. You can, when genuine, I'm not saying anybody should do anything false, but when genuine, to criticize the person, just to say, you know, that wasn't very nice, or why would you say that to me? And to sort of let that be known. Or even, it's interesting to criticize the narcissistic person in a way that he or she has criticized you. Again, only when genuine. But they get to say things to you, and if you say the same thing back, all of a sudden it's a terrible thing. So these are things that can be really, I think, really good examples of how you can test the relationship and begin to see what you get. Because if you do those things, then you stand back. So chances are, if you ask for something, the normal behavior would be like, oh my God, I wonder what's going to happen. But I'm talking about, you just ask for something and then you stand back. You know, there might very well be some kind of a fallout from it, but just stand back and see. And if there is, and particularly if you know that it's something that you've done for them, now what? They don't have to do it for you. You know what I mean? Like, you begin to get a more realistic picture of what's going on in the relationship.
I think it's also important to add here that if you have your programming to be this hyper-relational person where you take care of other people's needs, it may not even be within your consciousness that you can ask for equality. Mm-hmm. Like, you may be so used to doing things for other people and you would never ask them to do them for you because that's, it just right, isn't a part of your makeup. You've never done that before. And so even as you're talking, I can feel like my response is that I know so many people who would just, they would be horrified at the thought of asking for that, yeah, like a basic need to be.
I know. And they are, believe me. And that's the other thing, you know, people can be, I don't want to make it sound as though narcissists are mean and relational people are wonderful, you know, the good, bad thing. I mean, relational people can be very, if they feel threatened, if somebody feels like, even when I've talked about this, they can come out with some stuff, like, as if, as I said, accusing me of being that these ideas are very judgmental. And I think it's an important piece. It can also be really important for people to take time if they want to repel a narcissist. You know, a narcissist might need to very quickly have you tell them that they love them, that you love them. Sorry. And they may need to have that dynamic. That might be kind of what they need to put in place in order to move forward. But if you're, again, I'm only talking about doing what's real for you. I'm not talking about playing games here. I'm talking about actually finding what's genuine. Be yourself. That was my starting point. So if you now take more time to declare your feelings, just because the person might say, I love you, you don't have to say it back, or you don't have to be the first one to say it. You really should take time with that. Or to define your own direction and not just follow the other person's direction. You know, that your North Star, as it were, is something internal, not external, that you are looking to. It can take a lot of work, you know, to find out exactly who you are in this relationship or how you want to be.
So we are almost going on 2 hours here. So let's wrap it up in a minute here. I just want to say something that I think is really important and based on the work of Ross Rosenberg too, where I think a lot of people, if they are aware that they have these patterns, the hyper-relational piece where these things happen and you don't know how to repel the narcissist and you don't know if you've ever had a healthy relationship or if you're capable of it, I really invite you to look at that. And I think one thing that I think is really important is if you know that you have a pattern, it's almost like if you're attracted to somebody, you can be pretty sure that the pattern's going to replay itself. Mm-hmm. And so it's really important, especially if you're coming out of a divorce or a breakup, to take some time and dive into doing some work to understand your patterns and your history and what it is that programmed you to be the way that you are so that you can choose something different, because automatically we fall into the same thing if we're unconscious.
Yes. Yes. I think that's true. I just want to say one other thing, if I may.
Yeah.
Which is that if a person does decide or want to repel, to understand that there might be a lot of loss around that, because if you've engaged in these relationships, whether it's for your whole life or whether it's been for several years or whatever it may be, this may be a pervasive pattern on your part. So it's not just relationships with romantic relationships, but it might also be friendships. It might also be how you deal with family members. It's really, you know, how you've learned to function, for better or for worse. And at one time, it might have been what's called an adaptive behavior, meaning it helped you get through hard times. And now it's become more of a maladaptive behavior because it has created some strife in your life. But if you actually do change these behaviors, it's almost like a death. It's almost like, you know, you may very well lose relationships. People may not be happy to see the new you. They'll feel like this isn't what they signed up for. It's not the role you were supposed to keep in your family. It's not the role that you were supposed to maintain with your friends or in a relationship. So you might find yourself going through stages of grief where you are experiencing a tremendous loss, and it can be, you might need support in getting through that until you get to the point where you can access new resources and find new friendships and new relationships that are more of along the lines of what you want.
So this is like it almost feels like you're just adding something simple, but I think what you're talking about is absolutely devastating, and it's so important, and it happens all the time. When people get healthy, they experience what feels like abandonment.
Yeah.
Because they're not allowed to change the role. And
right.
One thing that I like to say to people, and I think it was Winnicott who said this, I'm not sure. What I like to talk about is this idea that everything you're afraid of has already happened. So I think there can be this fear where people hold on to relationships because they're terrified of being alone. And often my question would be, but aren't you kind of already alone? Mm-hmm. Like if we really look at the reality of the situation. But that's a really hard place to be, which is why I think a lot of people stay stuck, because they value the relationship, and being alone is terrifying.
Well, yeah. But you're talking about psychologically alone. I mean, you know, there are also certain very, very, very real practical considerations, because sometimes what goes along, I'm agreeing with you, but I'm just adding that sometimes what goes along with this is that a person has become isolated, let's say, and they don't have a job, and they now might have children or responsibilities or whatever that they really won't be able to meet if they're on their own. So there's the question of psychological aloneness, but there's also the question of losing the support, whether it's financial or having a home to live in, or, you know, various levels of it that they would have to somehow reproduce, and they may not be in the position to reproduce. And our particular society does not have a safety net for that. So that often, you know, people have said something about how they messed up, and it's really not so much that they messed up, it's that there's no safety net. Our particular society, our community, does not have a safety net for somebody who, I mean, there might be something, I can just imagine somebody saying, well, you can get some public service, but I'm talking about being able to live at the level that you've lived up to that point. So it becomes very complicated in that way too. Yeah, it's a really complicated discussion. I mean, this could go on for, we could go on for hours, and all of it would be really important and I hope beneficial to hear. So, but thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much. So I guess at the end, let's just sandwich this with, what practical advice do you have for anybody? I'm sure there's a lot of people who listen to this and may be triggered. These are really intense topics. Relationships are really tricky. Nobody's perfect. We all show up to relationships with our own levels of dysfunction, and we hurt people. But I would imagine that a lot of people are very triggered by this conversation. And so what advice would you give people who want to start unpacking and looking at their lives?
Well, that's a big question right there. I mean, I think, as I sit here listening and to respond, I would say, first of all, to only take as much as you can from about this, you know, to only listen to as much as you can. If something is triggering, then you might want to stop. I mean, that doesn't mean that you have to listen to the entire conversation. You can listen to pieces of it and listen to it when you're able or ready. And it doesn't make you a bad person to need to turn off the podcast and take some time. I think it's really important for people to be able to self-regulate around this, and to know if there's one thing, you know, just to sort of know what is your own truth and what you can tolerate, what you can't. Somebody can be in a relationship that someone else can look at and say, that's an awful relationship, but it's not for them to say. And I'm only here talking about this so that if people want to make changes, they can have some information. But I would never, ever be telling anybody that they have to do one thing or another. And I think that's really important for people to, if somebody's in, you know, they may be doing the best that they can. It's always a balance. Some people will say, I'm doing the best I can, I don't want to change. And some people would say, I'm doing the best I can, but I really do, or I'm not, and I really want to make some changes. And it's not for us to say, you or me.
Absolutely. So if anybody wanted to work with you, how would they find you? What sorts of things are you offering to the public?
Well, I mean, what I do, I'm an attorney, and I work with people who, therapists, who are either looking for guidance with ethics consultations or Department of Health complaints. So the way that this will come across for therapists is that they may be working with people who have personality disorders, or who are involved with people where there are problematic behaviors, and they themselves, the therapists, aren't doing. I'm hoping that they can do more in terms of the intake process or spotting some of these signs or understanding how to work with people who are involved in high conflict relationships. So that's where I would come in. I know that there are a lot of people, these problems come up a lot in divorce cases. I used to do that. I don't do that anymore, but I would say that they should try to find good people to help them with that, starting with having support for themselves, but also, if they are involved in a custody battle or in a divorce case, to find a lawyer or a therapist who understand this, to get the support, or even there are like coaches that you can find. So they could call me, and I can either, if it's a therapist, I can possibly help with the work that I do with them. But if someone needs another referral, they can call me and I can see if I can give them a referral. So they can, my website is FS. So Frances Shopik, FS at francesshopik.com. And that's FrancesShopik.com. That's a mouthful.
Yeah, I'll put it in the show notes so they can find you.
Yeah.
Okay, wonderful. So thank you so much for your experience, your wisdom, your insight. This has been an amazing conversation, and we could go forever. So I would imagine we'll probably go into another one in the future. So thank you so much.
All right. Well, thank you, Jasmine. It's been a pleasure. And I'm glad that you're doing this podcast. I'm sure it's going to be a service to many, many people.
Thank you. I hope so too.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Live Your Life podcast with me, Jasmine Savari, where I have inspiring conversations that invite you to fully live your life. I am a life coach and a licensed mental health counselor, but this podcast is not a replacement for counseling or healthcare services. If you find yourself in crisis, please call 911 or the National Crisis Line at 1-800-273-8255.